Welcome to the Serial Audiobook Alone, an unabridged podcast of Book 3 of the Generations Trilogy. Written by Scott Sigler. Performed by A. Kovacs. This novel is available in print as an ebook or as a full-length unabridged audiobook. For links to Amazon, Barnes & Noble, or Audible, please visit scottsigler.com/alone. Merry Christmas, junkies! Ho, 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 and a bottle of Brass Monkey to you this holiday season. I am still slugging away on Mount Fitzroy, over 105,000 words into this tasty, tasty tale. That's about 300 pages in print right now, and I may be halfway through. I'm not really sure. It is adding up. It might wind up being a very girthy book. Shocker. Still no idea when I'll be finished with this story. Sorry about that. No idea when we'll print it, etc., but I am working away on it. Hey, it's the Christmas season, the holiday season. There's food to eat. There's beer to drink. There's eggnog to consume. So I'm going to get you caught up on the story, and then I'll get back to my holiday celebrations, and we can all do Paul Revere's ride. Previously on Alone. In the last episode, Spingate tortured Bello to death. M, enraged, then beat Spingate, almost killing her and her unborn child. Who stopped M from murder? Aramovsky, the betrayer. As the next battle shapes up, M must deal with her rage even as she prepares the city for an inevitable assault.
Bishop and I can do nothing but stand and watch. One of us usually leads, but right now the fate of our people relies on Giles Borjigin. We're atop a wall tower. A thick stone battlement runs along the outside edge of the circular floor. The battlement is taller than I am, but there are notches cut into it so that people can look out. To the north, I see the river snaking off through the jungle ruins, slicing between the canyon of trees rising up on either side. To the south, I can see all of Ukmal, blackened, burned, coated in ash. Opkik is up here with us, as are five filthy circles awaiting their next task. Two of the circles, Mariel Brandor and Luis Gomez, have been trained to fire the cannon and will make sure it's working properly. We can't spare Circle Stars to crew the wall cannons, as we need them in the city streets, battling with rifle and spear and spider. Halves, gears, and circle crosses have important jobs to do when the fighting begins. We can't spare them either. What we can spare, as always, are circles. The circles up here are filthy because they've spent all morning raising a 5-meter-high dirt ramp against the city side of the tower. Up that ramp walks a metal giant. Borjigin is inside, piloting the massive two-legged 15-meter-tall construction machine that we found in the spider's nest, the same giant that he turned into a war machine at Aramovsky's command. In that battle, I ordered Spingate to fire shuttle missiles at the giant, which caused the death of the four people inside. I remember their names. Abrantes, Cadeau, Ashelman, Cody. They burned alive because of me. I feel Bishop's hand on my shoulder, squeezing, reassuring.
Are you thinking about when we stopped Aramovsky?
I nod.
You did what you had to do,
he says quietly.
It was war.
Using the word war frames my decisions, but it doesn't excuse them. We watch the giant machine continue up the ramp.
I don't think that's an excuse, I say. Spingate did what she thought she had to do. She's a murderer because of it, not a hero.
Bishop shakes his head.
Whatever Spingate is, her mind is too valuable to waste in a prison cell. You need to let her out and put her back to work.
She tortured a human being to death, I say. She'll stay where I put her.
Which is in a cell, right next to Aramofsky's. Aramofsky claims something took Teresa over, fanned the flames of her deepest fears, somehow forced one of the smartest people I know to listen to her most primitive, hateful instincts. She killed Bellow. Spingate will be punished. She is responsible for her actions.
But you felt it, didn't you? You felt the god of blood. You could have killed Spingate just as easily as Spingate killed Bellow. Killed Spingate and her unborn baby.
No, there's a difference. I didn't kill. But is that only because Aramofsky was there to interfere? I glance at Bishop. He went into a rage and almost killed Victor. If Victor had died, would I have put Bishop in a cell? If I'd been holding a real spear instead of a practice one, Bawden would be dead. Would I have put myself in jail? Would I have let someone else put me in there?
You're being stupid, Bishop says. This isn't the time for your morals if those morals get in the way of our survival. Spingate is special. Her mind is irreplaceable. What's more important, the accidental death of an enemy or the deaths of our people that might occur because she's locked up instead of being in the control room where she belongs?
I don't know the right answer to his question. Spingate has always been among the most reliable of the birthday children. Smart, self-sacrificing, dedicated, honorable. The fact that she, of all people, did what she did? It intensifies the sense of anger and dismay spreading through our people. Spingate, Bishop, me, the fight on the training ground, the belligerents, Barkha and his prisoner. Is something really making us all do evil things? Or are we just all evil to begin with?
Here we go,
Bishop says, nodding towards the giant.
We better get clear.
We press our backs against the curved battlement wall, making space for Opkick and the circles to work. Borjigin spent months rebuilding his giant, using tubes, wires, and other parts I don't understand from the hundreds of dead machines rusting away in the spider nest. He even painted over the giant's scorched metal frame, turning it from fire smudge black to a light blue dotted with bright bits of steel. Cables and cords of green and black snake through the framework. The left arm ends in a bright blue, three-fingered pincer. The right ends in a scoop shovel big enough for five people to stand in it comfortably. Right now, though, it holds today's prize, a long wall cannon, silvery metal blazing reddish in the afternoon sun. Opkick shouts instructions to Borjigin. The scoop rises above the battlements. The three-fingered pincer gently lifts the cannon from the scoop and sets it down in the center of the tower. Opkick barks out instructions to the circles, who scramble to fasten the cannon to bolts mounted in the stone.
That's the last one, Bishop says. I hope they're enough.
The wall surrounding Ukmal has 64 towers. Once upon a time, Borjigin tells me, every tower had a cannon. Out of all of those, he and the other halves were able to cobble together enough parts to make six working weapons. He spaced these evenly around the wall. If the city was a clock face and due north was 12 o'clock, we have cannons at 1, 3, 5, 7, 9, and 11. We're standing in the 1 o'clock tower. The 3 o'clock tower is the one above the east gate, and so on.
Use the signal flags, I say. Tell the observatory the cannon is in place. Bishop pulls an orange handheld flag from inside his coveralls. He steps to the tower's south edge and moves the flags in a simple pattern. 20 blocks away, someone atop a four-story ziggurat waves a much larger orange flag, mimicking Bishop's pattern. Moments later, I can just make out a third orange flag, another 20 blocks closer to the city center.
"It works," Bishop says. "Good. Between the flags and the horns, we'll be fine."
We've given up on the communication jewels. They don't work at all now, not even close to the observatory. Borjigin still doesn't know what's causing the interference, and he doesn't have time to figure it out. If the aliens land and we have a ground war, our combat units need to communicate with each other. Bawden came up with the idea of using signal flags to relay messages throughout the city. Lafa brought us more war horns. We'll also use those to coordinate troop movements, just like the Springers do in the jungle. Centuries ago, this city had a huge arsenal with which to defend itself. But time is the great destroyer. Machines and weapons went untended. Rust ate metal. Delicate parts corroded. Synthetic materials broke down. Other than bracelets, rifles, spears, knives, and farm tools, we don't have much. The observatory's automated defense, 6 tower cannons, 7 spiders, 4 heavy trucks converted from hauling dirt to hauling infantry, the big pig, and some small unarmored vehicles. And, of course, the Goff spear and its 3 remaining rounds. We have 4 platoons of human soldiers. I lead 1 platoon. Bishop, Farrar, and young Darzi lead the others. A platoon consists of 3 spiders, each with a crew of 3, and 12 infantry. Infantry. That's a funny word. It's supposed to mean trained soldiers. We have Circle Stars, yes, who have programmed memories and fighting skills, but most of them are physically only 13 years old. They are children with guns. And we don't even have enough of them, so the platoons are rounded out with a handful of circles. Shuttle kids, mostly, also physically 13 years old, but any combat training they've received has come in the last 6 months. We have help from Barca. 4 companies of his Malbinti warriors are hidden throughout the city. 200 soldiers in each company, armed with rifles and muskets. Inside our own walls, armed Springers now outnumber us over 3-1. A risk, yes, but if Bishop is right and the aliens land ground troops, it's a risk worth taking. There are more of Barkha's forces out in the jungle ruins, ready to defend Shechak. 8 companies organized into 2 battalions, 1,600 warriors ready to fight whatever comes their way. Assisting them are the Hurricane squads, D'Souza's demons and Lafa's creepers. The snake wolves are best suited for jungle warfare, so that's where they are stationed unless things really get out of hand here in Ukmal. If our new enemy lands among the trees, they are in for a serious fight. A long wail, rising and falling, reaches across the city. The emergency warning siren. Did the people in the control room detect incoming ships? Everyone atop the tower looks to the sky, searching this way and that. My heart races. We've prepared as best we can, but we're not ready. I hear it before I see it. The distant roar of a rocket echoing across the jungle canopy. Something about that sound is oddly familiar. Is it one of those fighters from the dragon? Or worse, a swarm of them? Bishop points north.
There!
Far out at the horizon, I see a black dot. Bishop shouts at the circles installing the silver cannon.
Get that weapon online! Right now!
The other wall cannons might have an angle, but it's flying straight at us. Our tower will have the best shot. It comes in low, skimming the yellow treetops. The noisy ship trails a thick, roiling cloud of black. Wait, the sound of that rocket. How do I know that sound?
Cannon is online!
Opkik shouts. Bishop points to Mariel and Luis.
Man your weapon!
They're shuttle kids, barely 13 years old. They look shocked. They have trained and trained, but this isn't a drill. This is real. Mariel sits in a metal chair mounted on the cannon's right side. She pulls a targeting rig close to her face, starts working the controls. Luis steps to the weapon's left side, where he'll monitor a dozen different settings. The enemy ship is coming in low, fast, and loud. The white crystal atop the silver cannon begins to glow. A blazing white beam fires from our left, coming in from the 11 o'clock tower. It misses the incoming ship, leaves a shimmering reverse image streamer dancing across my vision. I see a small fireball rise up from the jungle, where the beam touched down. Now I realize why the ship is flying at tree level. It's below the top of the city wall, meaning most of our cannons can't get a line of sight on it. Just one ship. Why just one?
Weapon charged!
Luis shouts. His voice breaks on charged. He's so young, he's still in puberty. He sounds as scared as he looks.
Targeting!
Mariel says. She's shaking. Icons flash on her display. An image of the ship, a crosshairs lined up on it. That ship. It's larger in the targeting display. I can make out details I can't with my naked eye. It's not sleek as I expected. It's black and it's lumpy. It's the same ship that brought Bello down a year ago, that took Matilda and old Gaston back up to the Zolotl.
Stop!
I scream as I rush at Mariel, yank her hands away from the controls. I turn to Bishop.
That ship is ours! Signal all batteries to cease fire!
He doesn't second guess me, even for an instant. He faces south, starts making sharp signals with his flag. A beam of light lashes out from the southeast, from the 3 o'clock tower. This beam grazes the lumpy ship's back, lashing up a splattering wave of molten metal. The ship starts to tremble. It dips down into the trees, vanishes for a second, then arcs back up above the canopy in an eruption of leaves and vines. The shuddering ship struggles to rise. It's not going to make it over the vine-covered wall. I grip the slot in the battlements, pouring my will into that ship. Climb! Climb, damn it! It's going to smash into the wall just to our right. It climbs. I wince as it reaches the wall. The ship's belly grinds against the stone edge and bounces over, trailing a cloud of pulverized stone, spinning vine leaves and billowing smoke. The lumpy ship tilts hard right and drops towards the wide north-south street that is La Tu Way. It whizzes by blackened stone buildings on either side. Cones of fire shoot out from all over the lumpy ship, fluttering and flickering in an effort to keep it level. It slows dramatically as the already ruined undercarriage slams into the street with an ear-splitting spray of sparks as metal grinds against stone. The ship slides to a stop some 25 blocks south of our position. A massive shadow above my head makes me duck. The huge scoop shovel of Borjigan's giant touches down on the tower floor with barely a clank. In the giant's head, through light blue bars and a slot cut into metal plating, I see Borjigan's face.
M, get in, he shouts. Let's go!
Bishop and I scramble into the scoop. Borjigan lifts it clear. The giant machine turns. Long strides take it down the earthen ramp onto La Tu Way. Each thundering step makes the big machine tremble, rattling us in the scoop. Bishop and I hold on tight as big legs chew up the distance. I flick my wrist left and then right. Bishop does the same. Our bracelets glow with a promise of death. We reach the ship in minutes. It's twisted and broken. It will clearly never fly again, but it's mostly in one piece. Thin smoke curls up from a dozen tiny tears and cracks. The nose cone is badly dented. Bishop waves at Borjigin to get his attention, then points to the ground. A hatch opens on the back of the giant's head. There is a long ladder running down the giant's spine, but Borjigin ignores it. With agility I would have never expected from him, he balance walks along the giant's shoulder and down its arm towards us. He jumps into the scoop, then waves at someone still inside the chest.
Put us down!
A whir of machinery, the hiss of hydraulics. The scoop hits the ground. We scramble out onto the street. The lumpy black ship seems much bigger up close. 8 to 10 people would fit inside it comfortably. Bishop runs to the nose cone, looks through a crack.
I think there's someone moving in there.
Borjigin sprints to the side of the ship, finds a door just behind the cockpit. The door is badly bent and refuses to open enough for him to enter. Bishop and I join in. The three of us yank and yank until the door pops open with a shriek of complaining metal. I scramble into the ship's shadows, Bishop at my heels. Sunlight filters through cracks in the hull, lighting up beams of swirling smoke. A black form falls out of the pilot seat. It's a grown-up, gnarled and thin, wearing the metal frame and clear mask that lets them breathe on Omayokin. I can't make out the face through all this smoke. I aim my bracelet. Bishop does the same. The grown-up is trembling, coughing so hard its thin body shudders. Its skinny legs are twisted, misshapen, and limp. It lifts its head. A sunbeam finds its way through the cracked hull to light up the grown-up's visor and the face behind it. Two bulbous red eyes look at me, eyes that whirl with a soft red glow.
Little savage,
it says between violent coughs.
Do be a sweetie and don't kill me a second time.
It's Brewer. I can't believe it. I lower my arm. What are you doing here? He raises a trembling coal black arm, points a bone-thin finger behind Bishop and me.
Beware the cherished who bear gifts, he says. Or who give bears with chairs that itch.
Bishop and I both turn and look deeper into the ruined, lumpy ship. Through the swirling sunbeam smoke, I see a long shape, thick straps holding it tight against gray foam padding. I recognize the shape. You've got to be kidding me, I say. Bishop looks from the shape to me, then back to the shape again.
What is it?
I saw something like it up on top of the observatory. Only that one was broken up into 100 pieces. This one? This one is new. This one is whole. It's an antenna, I say. Brewer brought us an antenna. I'm in the hospital. Kenzie Smith and I stand next to a closed, white coffin. Inside it, Brewer. He's in bad shape, Kenzie says. His left side took the brunt of it. Broken tibia, fibula broken in 3 places, fractured femur, broken hip bone. A couple of cracked ribs for good measure, although I've never seen ribs like his before. Whatever they did to make grown-ups live for so long changed their bodies immensely. Brewer passed out as soon as we tried to move him. I'll never forget his scream of pain. Bishop used his signal flags to call for vehicles and medical help. Nevins, Pira, and Harmon rushed to the crash site almost as fast as Kenzie did. Once Brewer was safely away, they crawled into the lumpy ship, excited beyond any level of self-control. They oohed and aahed over the antenna, squealed with delight at finally understanding where a few of their mystery parts were supposed to go. Some bits broke in the crash, but the boys are confident that between the new and the old, they now have enough working pieces to make a functioning antenna.
How long until he's out of there? I ask Kenzie.
Depends on if you want him on his feet or in a wheelchair. That hip will take weeks in the med chamber, if I can heal him at all. His bones are so brittle.
I don't care if he can walk as long as he can talk.
He risked his life to deliver the antenna. Why? Can he tell us why the Zolotl came to Omiokin? Can he tell us why the alien ships are here?
There's something else, Kenzie says. He's dying. Of course he's dying. He's 1,000 godsdamned years old.
She shakes her head. He's got small cell carcinoma. It's metastasized. Kenzie stares at me for a moment, all solemn, waiting for a response. I shrug.
I don't know what that means.
She waves her hand over the top of the white pedestal next to the coffin. An image sparkles to life. The outline of a thin man, legs together, hands at his sides. The image is white. His chest is dotted with spots of deep green. There are spots of green all over him, including his head. He has lung cancer, she says, and it has spread to his lymph nodes, his liver, his bones, his brain. I'm not even sure how he can function at all. He must be in excruciating agony. I look at the white coffin, as if I can suddenly see through it to the gnarled, ancient man inside. I think back to when I first spoke to him, up on the Zolotl. Lung cancer, I say.
Would that make you cough? At his stage, yes, a lot. So cure him. The coffins can fix that, right?
Kenzie shakes her head. Med chambers can do a lot, but some things are beyond the technology. Zubiri's arm. Delilah's leg. Some things can't be healed.
How long until he dies?
Kenzie thinks this over for a moment, runs a hand through her hair. Based on what I know, what I see, he should have been dead a year ago. I honestly don't know how he's still alive. He can't have more than a few weeks left. A few days, probably. If he dies before he can tell us why he came...
Fix what you can as fast as you can, I say. Then wake him up.
I turn to leave.
Wait,
Kenzie says. I need to talk to you about Spingate. She's extremely upset. My jaw tightens.
She's a murderer. Her feelings are not important to me right now.
You won't let her see her own child. It's killing her.
Which means the baby is safe, I say.
Kenzie rubs her eyes.
Teresa wouldn't hurt little Kevin. And I wouldn't have thought she could hurt Bello either.
This is taking a toll on Kenzie, draining her. She looks at me with an expression I've become all too familiar with. She wants this to make sense. She wants answers. Answers that I don't have. Teresa is the sweetest person I know, Kenzie said. How could she have done that to Bello?
I don't know,
I say. Kenzie glances at the lines of coffins. She shivers.
What's happening to us, Em? When is this going to stop?
I've never seen her this distraught.
I have no idea, I say. I'm doing the best I can.
She forces a smile.
I know, but please... Reconsider not letting Spin see her baby, all right?
I think of Bello, hanging by her wrists, and Spingate, holding the bloody rod. Was that really a one-time thing, or could it happen again?
I'll think about it, I say.
Kenzie looks off, nods, then goes back to work on the pedestal display next to Brewer's coffin.
And And that was Alone episode number 11. Brewer is back, yo. He has lived over 1,000 years. But man, the majority of those years have been spent in agony and in madness. Kind of makes you wonder about wanting to live forever, doesn't it? What will his impact on the birthday children be? And what will his impact be on the city of Ukmul? Will the antenna let M communicate with the Zolotl and possibly Matilda? Find out next week on Alone, episode number 12. And until then, happy holidays! And we will talk to you all real soon. You have been listening to Alone, book 3 in the Generations trilogy. Written by Scott Sigler. Performed by A. Kovacs. Produced by Scott Sigler and engineered by Steve Rickyberg. Follow Scott on Twitter and Instagram, where his handle is at Scott Sigler, S-C-O-T-T-S-I-G-L-E-R, one word, or join our Facebook group at facebook.com/Scott Sigler. Theme music is the song Unseen Horrors by Kevin MacLeod.